Okay. A final repetition of our refuge and bodhicitta prayer. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings, prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Sending record permission to John. I am recording John on the cloud. And teacher prayers will come after the meditation today, since Lama Jinzong will be finishing the chapter 7 in Gampopa's Ornament of Precious Liberation, the section on loving kindness and compassion in Ringu Tulku. So just checking my notes to see if there's anything I'm forgetting. Right. So we'll begin again by bringing our minds more fully to rest, having done our prayers. Follow the breath for a few rounds. Rest in open awareness, however you prefer to bring your mind into a restful, undistracted state. As always, allowing thoughts to come and go as they please. Just not hopping on the train of thought. Senses completely open. Just takes a little bit of attention to follow the breath if you're choosing to do that. And then quick review of the four thoughts, which is a good way to begin any session of practice. Remembering the precious human existence, how very fortunate we are to have everything we need to realize the Buddha's teachings in this lifetime, really opening our heart to fully appreciate that. Letting that appreciation suffuse our awareness. And then remembering that this opportunity will come to an end through impermanence and death. It can happen anytime, so we need to not waste our time while we have it. Remembering the law of karma, that it's our own actions that determine what happens to us in the future, whether it's happiness, suffering, or liberation. It's up to us. And remembering the suffering of samsara, since there's no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence, we must use this life to free ourselves and others from it. And these last two of the four thoughts, remembering karma, remembering the suffering of samsara, are the antidotes to wasting our time by getting caught up in worldly pleasures and distractions. And now our guru yoga, remembering the Lama or the Buddha above the crown of our head on a lotus and moon seat in a body of light, radiating love, compassion, the very things we're studying, radiating bodhicitta, radiating complete awakening, wishing to attain that level of realization ourselves, that level of love and compassion ourselves. We request the blessing of the Lama. We let our mind mix with the Lama's mind and receive the blessing of his realization, the Buddha's realization. And then having received the blessing, the Lama comes to rest in our heart center, continuing to radiate all of those qualities, continuing to radiate love and compassion all the time, whether we're aware of it or not. We can always tune into it. And now we're going to cultivate ultimate bodhicitta in a different way today. This is a meditation that we used in the 37 practices based on the ultimate bodhicitta verses 22 through 24. And it also relates to a passage I'm going to reread from last week. You don't need to open your book because you're resting in meditation. Right at the end of Lama Jinzang's teaching last week, Ringu Tulku reminded us of three ways of dealing with obscuring emotions such as desire, anger, and so forth. And the first one was to think of the opposite emotion. That one's really easy and intuitive. The second one is that of the Mahayana, and that's the one we're going to practice today. We're not going to bring up a negative emotion today, but we're going to practice on just ordinary garden variety thoughts because it's exactly the same process. So those are the two. Then the third one is the method of Vajrayana, where you just accept and rest in the emotion, but we're not going to practice that today. Whatever teachings you've had, you can practice these three methods that way. But the second method, to reread Ringu Tulku's short paragraph, the second method for dealing with one's emotions as we work to cultivate love and compassion and to diminish and eventually eradicate anger and desire and so forth, the second method for dealing with one's emotions is that of the Mahayana, which consists in understanding emptiness along with the previous method. In other words, if we understand the true nature of anger, the real nature of the mind, then when anger appears, all we have to do is contemplate that there is no one to irritate us, no one getting angry, and no anger inside us existing independently. And Ken MacLeod is going to guide us through how to do that with any sort of thought or emotion that arises. Ringu Tulku says, to arrive at this understanding, there are two techniques, analysis and meditation. We can approach the emotion or the thought by analyzing it intellectually, or we can contemplate it through meditation. We let anger or the other thought or emotion invade us and we look at it. We'll then discover that anger doesn't exist independently. In both cases, anger disappears. More precisely, we discover that there is no one thing that we can isolate as I or as anger. The anger disappears through our understanding, our realization of the true nature of phenomena and of our mind. That's the way of Majjhimaka, the way of the bodhisattvas, using analysis to recognize the true nature of thoughts and emotions as they arise. So this is from Ken's meditation. So he says, begin your session by following the breath for a few slow, relaxed breaths. And we already did that, but we can remind ourselves of that. Breathing slowly in a relaxed way, letting ourselves rest just as it is, letting the mind and body settle naturally. And within this state of resting, bring any thought or image to mind. If there's something already in your mind, you can look at that. Or if you don't have any particular thought or emotion in your mind, just bring up anything. A word, a phrase, a picture, a sound, any sort of mental phenomenon. Giving everybody a moment. If you don't have anything else, the Statue of Liberty is always good. So then you ask, where is that thought or where is that image? Where is it actually existing? So we actually ask ourselves that question. And we can go deeper into detail. Is it inside our head? Is it outside our head? So we're really looking for where is the location of that thought or that emotion. We can say it's in our mind, but what does that mean? Where is it if it's in our mind? It is there. It is vivid, so we're hanging on to this thought or this image, or we're coming back to it as we ask the questions again. It is there, it is vivid, but where is it? And we're not breaking our heads on this, we're just looking. Ken says, look without thinking. Don't try to figure it out, just look. Where is it? And then he gives us the answer. You cannot say. So if you did not find where that thought or that emotion was located, you got the right answer, or you agreed with Ken MacLeod and other teachers. You cannot say where it is. You can't pinpoint its location. So just rest there. You cannot say, so don't try to say. Just rest there, resting and gently looking. So we don't worry about where it is, where it actually is, what the right answer is. We just ask the question, where is it? And we can ask a few follow-ups. Is it here? Is it there? Is it in between here and there? We don't find an answer and we rest in that. So the point of this meditation is to bring us to that state of recognizing that there isn't an answer. And we just rest there. So it could be very open and spacious now. You know, having looked, having asked the question, look, then we just open up our awareness again. We don't have to keep looking and keep asking. But if you were working with a persistent thought or a difficult emotion, you could keep asking. You would ask, rest, and then when it comes back, you could do the same thing again. Ask again, where is this thing that keeps bugging me? Don't find it. Be at peace with not finding it. Rest in that until it comes back again. And then go through the process again. And eventually you find yourself resting in open awareness. So his second step, which we'll do very briefly, is do the same with a feeling. So this is the point, is that you can do this with a strong emotion. Do the same with a feeling such as anger, love, joy, grief, anxiety, compassion. So let's work with love. Let's all just bring to mind someone we love. And this is going to take us into taking and sending. But first, we're going to look at the emotion of love. So let us just fill our hearts with love, either in an abstract way, because we know what that feels like, or you can bring someone to mind that you love. Bring it to mind and ask, where is it? Feel the physical sensations associated with the emotion. Love has a feeling in our body, so let's look at that for a moment. And then ask, is the emotion the same as the physical sensation? Apart from the physical sensation, where is the emotion itself? So having asked the question, we let go of the question, we just look gently, and we rest in whatever that leaves us with. And again, Ken says, you cannot say where it is. No one can. Just rest there, looking and resting. And by looking here, it doesn't mean we're taking out the microscope and scrunching up our eyes or scrunching up our minds. The looking is just a little bit of intensification of how we're resting, tuning into the nature of what it is we can't describe. So now, having brought this feeling of love to our mind and to our heart, let's cultivate relative bodhicitta by bringing to mind someone we associate with a feeling of love, someone we feel love toward, a person, an animal, anybody. And if you prefer to work with all sentient beings, that's fine. And we're going to breathe, we're going to apply both love and compassion. We're going to think of the suffering that this person or animal has, or that all beings have. We're going to breathe it in and take it away from them because we don't want them to have it, and that is compassion. Breathe in all of their suffering, free them from it, let it dissolve in our heart center, our vast Buddha nature, and breathe out love, that feeling of wanting them to be happy and wanting them to have whatever will bring them happiness. And we alternate like this briefly. Practice taking and sending, alternately synchronizing with the breath. Breathing in their suffering, freeing them from it is compassion. Breathing out love and whatever they need is love. And remembering that what we're breathing in, they're suffering, and what we're breathing out, love, we can't say where it is. We can't identify it. We can't pinpoint it. But we can breathe in the suffering and we can breathe out the love, even if we can't know more about it than that. And now extending our meditation, our intention to all sentient beings, if we're not already doing that, breathing in all the suffering of every sentient being throughout the six realms of existence, throughout space, letting it dissolve and breathing out happiness, breathing out the wish for them to be happy, breathing out love. And now letting go of the visualization, all the thoughts, all the conceptuality, coming back to a state of open awareness within which, if you wish, you can use some of your attention to follow your breath. Freeing our mind from all concerns, all thoughts and emotions. And now coming back to listen to Lama Jinzong chant the teaching prayers.
Did you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, you're unmuted. Sorry, I had muted myself.
Oh, okay. My dad just walked by, that's why I was keeping. So I begin with the four dharmas of Gampopa. Datta Semchen Tan, Cheji Lo Ju Su Jo War Sin Ji Lop Du So, Chu Lam Du Jo War Sin Ji Lop Du So, Lam Ju Par Se War Sin Ji Lop Du So, Ju Po Ye Shi Su Jo War Sin Ji Lop Du So. I pray for a blessing, may my mind and the mind of all beings, sentient beings, turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. And now from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dan lu dan nu ji ke jubu data ni I ke nan tang jawa kun ji dra ke ji san par tan che ke du da ki chu ten do in the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans do. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And then the reminder for rousing bodhicitta at the beginning of teachings. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So thank you, Lama Chödrön, for leading us in the meditation. Last week, we left off I'll be working today from two books, our main books, Path of Buddhahood, and then this version of Ornament of Precious Liberation. So last week I had left off with page 57 in Path to Buddhahood. I lied. I did not do that. I left off on page 59. I think I'll begin again, if you don't mind, page 57, just as a reminder to begin again. And just to remind everybody that love and compassion is the third antidote, and it's the antidote to remaining in the peace of nirvana, the antidote being that by developing loving kindness and compassion, we can overcome the egotistical wish to find the peace of meditation and nirvana to get out of samsara alone. That if we see the logic of compassion, we'll naturally try to attain enlightenment in order to help other beings. So I'm going to begin then with page 57. And hopefully we'll have time today. We didn't have time last week to do any discussion. I know that he brings up certain points, knowing about the culture of the Western versus Eastern. And I know that he brings up the issue of having difficulty with your root mother, meaning the mother of this life. So if anyone wanted to touch on that again, we can do at the end of this session. But I thought I would just first begin with carrying on, finishing the chapter, which includes a nice meditation, and then we can have time for discussion. So again, page 57 reads, and this is training and dealing with emotions. When we encounter difficult and conflicting emotions, we're usually too overpowered by our own negative emotions to have the time or the presence of mind to think of love. Simply, so again, this is still a little bit of reiteration on love and kindness. So simply listening to teachings about love and compassion won't change us immediately or transform us on the spot into perfect bodhisattvas. We will, of course, flare up in anger again, especially if we're of an angry disposition. We should feel neither guilty nor even uneasy if this happens. What is important is not to get attached to this anger, not to feed it or attempt to justify it. There's a difference between getting angry and feeding anger. Even Talopa said that the simple fact of being angry doesn't do us much wrong. However, the attachment to anger and the desire for revenge are really bad and can harm us greatly. We should consider what benefit there is in maintaining this anger and being attached to it. There's none. It only hurts us and hurts others. By developing loving kindness and we can gradually change. By remaining vigilant and conscious of the uselessness of anger, we'll be better able to control ourselves. We'll gradually get less and less often angry over little things, and the intensity of our anger will also diminish. It doesn't mean that we should hold back and repress all feelings of anger, but simply that we should change the orientation of our mind. Emotions are like waves, and they always calm down. Whenever we become conscious that we're getting angry, we should try to divert our attention to something else that can take the place of our angry feelings. And this is where then he goes into the three different ways to meditate, and of which Lama Chodron already gave us a brief discussion about, the first being to simply, the first is this antidote, it says, of the shravakas, or of the hearers, which is to deal with the negative motion by thinking of the opposite motion, so emotion. So simply, you know, the idea is when you're feeling, you know, bad about something, or something's creating negativity in your mind, you can simply, like, make a choice to say, you know what, I'm not going to go there. And just bring to mind something that makes you feel relaxed, or, you know, provide some kind of relief. And, you know, allow yourself not to indulge. Allow yourself to go, I'm just not going to go there. I'm going to think about something that actually makes me feel good. So that it says at the end of the full chapter at the bottom, it says, you know, it's like heating a room so that the cold disappears. We don't repress the cold. We simply heat the room. And then the second method for dealing is, as we've just done now with the practice, the instructions that Lama Chodron led us through, which is the Mahayana method. And then, as she also said on page 59, there's the third, the tantric method of the Vajrayana. So again, if you've had training in the Vajrayana, and if this works for you, then you can apply what you, the methods you've done. But what he says that at the end, right before the next section, he says, these are the three Buddhist methods for controlling emotions. So the point is that you can try to use all the three methods, either in this or random order, or it's basically what you, what you've been trained in, that's how you can work with it. So briefly, I'll start again with, now this is new material. It says, the signs and benefits of having developed loving kindness. Through this training, we gradually learn to live without feelings of hatred, even towards our enemies. We progressively develop more and more loving kindness. The texts say that love can be considered to be genuine when tears come to our eyes and we have goose flesh when we think of sentient beings' sufferings. So I guess that goose flesh means goose pimples. If that's what we feel for all other beings, we can speak of infinite love and compassion. If we're no longer concerned with our own personal interest, but our only concern is the well-being of others, then we have perfectly developed loving kindness. This practice enables one to accumulate the greatest merits. Gampopa quotes, so this I'm going to read from this, but this was is covered by Gampopa himself in the chapter. He quotes from the Garlands of Jewels, or the Garland of Jewels, which says, the merit of giving three times a day, every day, 300 meals fit for a king, cannot even begin to compare with that created by a single instant of loving kindness. So what that brought to mind is that, again, you know, even if you're providing that kind of generosity, who knows if there's pride, if there's attachment to the activity of giving itself, the fact that you can give that much. That this idea of what does it mean, that single instant of loving kindness, and as I spoke last week about, was that example of when Lama Norla Rinpoche said to us in one of my retreats, when there were about six of us living in the room, and said, can you imagine where, you know, here we are in this, you know, enclosed environment, and, you know, you're just picking on anybody, blaming everything and anything for your own feeling of crappiness, when in fact most of the day you're sitting in your room alone, and yet when you get like completely, you know, stuck on something and stew over something someone said or whatever, he said, can you imagine the feeling of love and kindness when the six of you in this room, you can't even feel like, may each and every person in this room have exactly what they need, exactly what they want, which basically means I give up all control, you know, whatever set of conditions I'm clinging to as needing to make me feel good. I give all of that self-centered self-absorption up, and whatever anyone else needs, may they have it with like genuine, absolute lack of attachment, lack of pride, that's what it really means. So that just came to mind here. What, you know, what does it mean to say, well, you can give, you know, a zillion meals fit for a king, and yet that doesn't compare to a single instant of loving kindness? Because personally, I can't imagine, you know, I know, oh, it's lovely to cook for people and I enjoy the Sangha offering, and yet, you know, I'm sitting with one other person in the room and I'm getting like cranky because they're making a noise or something that I don't like in that moment. So anywho, okay. So then it gives a thing, it continues, it says, Gampopa also mentions the eight positive effects of cultivating love and kindness. Okay, so this one I have issues with, but regarded. It says it's listed in the same sutra, to be loved by gods and humans, to be protected by gods and humans, to have a joyous mind, to encounter pleasant circumstances, not to be the victim of poisoning, not to be wounded by weapons, to be able to achieve one's most of one's aspirations, and finally to be born in the divine realms. These eight results endure until we definitely are definitely liberated from samsara. So my thought here is that we can look in our own experience and see that, you know, beings who we feel are actually like very far on the path, you know, great teachers who we do see seeming to be victims of unpleasant circumstances and illness, etc. And so to be reminded that, you know, it's, you know, that we can never know what's going on, and karma really continues to ripen until, you know, you ultimately are free. And yet they say that, again, bodhisattvas demonstrate all types of things. That, first of all, they exhibit or manifest old age and death to help remind us of impermanence. So again, when I see things like this, you know, and I go like, ew, what does that mean? I, you know, that doesn't match with my experience. That's how I'm relating to this material. Now we're going to skip down just to the last paragraph in that heading where it says, meditating on loving kindness protects us like an armor from all negative influence. Even better, this meditation allows us to help and be helped. When we feel well cared for, helped by what we could call positive energies, it isn't some external energy but our own loving kindness that does the work. Healing through love is an effective traditional method. I find that very interesting because also, again, often people talk of external conditions to create, you know, that provide happiness. So this idea that you could say, well, I'm feeling positive energy, but it's in fact a reflection or a projection of one's own energy. You know, that when one is feeling peaceful, then one is not projecting out anything negative. You know, it's and you wouldn't be, you know, positive conditions around possibly wouldn't resonate in the same way that they do when you are from your own side experiencing peace of mind or, you know, relaxed spaciousness. Does anyone have any thoughts before we move on to, now we're on to the development of compassion? Okay. So, moving on, but what I need to do is, because I have one little thing that I have to look at, and so I just have to get us into, okay, there we go. So now we're continuing with the development of compassion, and it says the second aspect of the third antidote, again, the third antidote meaning developing love and compassion so that you're not just self-centeredly wanting to attain freedom from suffering, but that you want to include all beings in that aspiration. The first aspect was love and kindness, and the second is compassion. And it says, and I'm on page 61, compassion is the heart, the essence of all Buddhist teachings. If you understand what compassion is and practice it, you practice Buddhism. Without compassion, you're not practicing Buddhism. The Buddha also said that if you have compassion, you possess all the teachings and practices of Buddha. If you lack compassion, you've understood nothing at all. Just as we've distinguished three forms of love, there are also three forms of compassion. The first with reference to sentient beings, the second with reference to the Dharma, and third with reference, without reference point. So the first type of compassion awakens in us when we see the misery, problems, and sufferings of other beings. We're moved, touched, and we feel the desire to help them get out of their misery. We want to do something for them. And so I'm turning now to page in this white text, Ornament of Precious Liberation, to 94, because I found, and I'm going to go back and forth a little bit just between these two books briefly, because there are certain things that are mentioned in Gampopa's text that are a little different or add flesh out or add a little different flavor. So I'm now on page 94 in Ornament of Precious Liberation, where it says the first kind of is compassion. So it's like the last full paragraph on the page. It says, the first kind is compassion that arises through understanding the sufferings of being in the lower states of existence. So that's a little difference that he's only moving towards the lower states, because in... again, in Rinko Toku's, he's talking about the first kind of compassion awakens in us when we see the misery, problems, and sufferings of other beings. It seems to be like in all realms that, well, whatever we can see, we're touched by and feel the desire to help them get out of misery. Continuing on page 94, and this is again with reference to Dharma, it says, the second occurs when there is familiarity with the meaning of the four truths of the Noble Ones, and hence understanding of both causes and consequences, thereby counteracting belief in permanent concrete realities. And what I did was, I just wanted to remind myself, and so I'll just share with you, I guess I could share this screen here just because, how do I share the screen? I don't want to sort of...
Do you have a share?
Oh, yeah, I see. Okay, share. Okay, desktop one. Share. Do you see my screen? You're seeing my screen now? So this is a reminder of just the four Noble Truths that I got just on the internet. And so it says again, what are the four Noble Truths? Buddhism's famed four Noble Truths are noble because they liberate us from suffering. They are the Buddha's basic teaching encapsulating the entire Buddhist path. So the first is the truth of suffering. Life always involves suffering in obvious and subtle forms. Even when things seem good, we always feel an undercurrent of anxiety and uncertainty inside. Second, the truth of the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is craving and fundamental ignorance. We suffer because of our mistaken belief that we are a separate, independent, solid I. The painful and futile struggle to maintain this delusion of ego is known as samsara, or cyclic existence. And then the truth of the cessation, the end of suffering. The good news is that our obscurations are temporary. They are like passing clouds that obscure the sun of our enlightened nature, which is always present. Therefore, suffering can end because our obscurations can be purified. An awakened mind is always available to us. And last, the fourth, the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. By living ethically, practicing meditation, and developing wisdom, we can take exactly the same journey to enlightenment and freedom from suffering that the Buddhas too. We too can wake up. Okay. And Jojen, I think you're unmuted at the moment.
I am.
Okay. So that, I just wanted to remind us of the four thoughts. So I'm just going back now. We're back on page 94. So again, I'll start again. It says, the second occurs when there's a familiarity with the meaning of the four truths of the Noble Ones, and hence understanding of both causes and consequences, thereby counteracting belief in permanent concrete realities. Compassion arises through realizing how much other beings are unaware of karmic cause and effect, and how they perceive things as concrete and lasting. And now we return to Rinko Tuku's book, page 61. And it's the paragraph that says the second type. So again, it's very short, but I just wanted to cover it. It says, the second type of compassion marks an increase in our level of understanding. The first stage is very emotional, and we ourselves suffer at the sight of the misery of others. To access the second level of compassion shows that our understanding of Dharma and the Four Noble Truths, and therefore our compassion, is deeper. And now going on to the third type of compassion, I'm returning to page 94, where we left off in this text, the white text of Ornament of Precious Liberation, where he says, the third kind of compassion occurs when meditative penetration has brought realization of the emptiness of all phenomena. Extraordinary compassion then arises towards sentient beings who believe in real existence. As it says, when through meditative equipoise, a bodhisattva becomes perfected through practice, compassion arises in particular towards those gripped by the demon of believing in reality. And so now we return to page 61, where we left off in Rinko Tuku. The third type of compassion comes with the total understanding, the perfect realization of the true nature of things, of shunyata, and that's emptiness. We then clearly We then see clearly that those beings who suffer so much have in fact no need to suffer. They suffer because they're confused, because they think and see things in an erroneous way. If they could just look at things differently without conceptualizing, they could be free of all suffering. Compassion becomes very vivid when we see that the sufferings, although clearly omnipresent, are in fact baseless and so easy to eliminate. What separates beings from liberation is such a thin partition. And yet by ignorance, by misunderstanding the true nature of things, they suffer intensely and perfectly needlessly. Having gone to the other side ourselves, we see the waste which causes great compassion to spontaneously arise in us. Simultaneously, we lose any reference point by understanding that the beings who suffer don't exist in any real, solid, substantial way. So from our point of view, there's no reference point because we're not seeing any truly existent thing that we can point to as being there's the center and there's, you know, there's the end. There's no reference point. Of course, at a relative level, that is to say, from their point of view, they do suffer greatly. The union of wisdom and compassion arises out of the realization of the true nature of things. This is the very heart of the Buddha, compassion without reference. This last type of compassion is the objective of the two previous ones, but of course, to start with, we must develop compassion with reference to sentient beings. So we're going to begin here. We're going to read Rinko Tuku's explanation of the meditation, and then I'm actually going to turn back to Ornament of Precious Liberation in Kampopa, and we'll actually do meditation. Okay. So again, I'm continuing page 62 in Rinko Tuku. The method that allows us to develop compassion is identical to that used for developing loving kindness. We visualize our mother and imagine her undergoing great suffering. Imagine her being tortured. What would be the intensity of our compassion? Now, other beings, like those reborn in hell, continuously suffer such incredible tortures. According to our tradition, we think of our mother. But you can visualize in her place the person for whom you feel the greatest love and imagine how much you love him or her, how you couldn't stand it if anything bad happened to that person. Having developed this strong feeling, you try to extend it to other beings, aware that you once had with all other beings the same relationship that you have had with this person. We've wandered in samsara for such a long time that all beings have at some point been our mothers, our close relatives, or our friends. Sorry. Children, you're yawning. Sorry. Okay, hold on.
I've now muted myself. Sorry.
Sorry. Okay, anywho. All right, back to reminding ourselves of whoever we feel the greatest love for and imagine, you know, how much we love them, how we couldn't stand it if anything bad happened to them. And again, developing this feeling, remembering that all other beings have at one time had a super close relationship, that it's saying we've wandered in samsara for such a long time that all beings have at some point been our mothers, our close relatives, or our friends. All these beings have had the same love and compassion for us as the love and kindness that our mother has extended to us in this life. It is therefore normal to feel for them the same love, the same gratitude, and the same compassion that we feel for our mother in this life. The basic idea is that if we can love one person very strongly, we can develop the same feeling for 2, 10, or 10,000 people or more. First, we develop benevolence and compassion for those who are close to us, and then we extend these feelings to those to whom we are indifferent, and finally include our enemies. Instead of imagining our mother or someone who is dear to us, we can also imagine what we would experience if we ourselves had to endure the unbearable tortures of the different infernal realms, and in this way develop a great compassion for all the beings who suffer likewise. All sentient beings seek happiness, well-being, peace, and security. But through ignorance, they do the exact opposite of what would ensure the enduring happiness they seek. They accumulate bad karma and acquire again and again the causes of subsequent suffering, like blind men in the middle of a burning desert, walking around in circles, not knowing how to get out. We aspire to happiness and we fear suffering, and other beings are no different from us on this point. When we recognize this evidence, we naturally wish to help them. So now if everybody can just take a moment now to let go and relax, just we're going to, I'll lead you through a guided meditation, which is on page 95 of the Ornament of Precious Liberation in this white text. But again, you don't have to follow it. I'm just going to be a reading. And like we did last time, we're going to begin by just adjusting our posture and taking a moment to relax. Again, noticing if we're having any tension or stress, or, you know, if we're gripping in any particular area of the body, to allow ourselves to just let go of gripping, or try to relax the stress or tension in our body. And just relax. So now again, the instruction is to based on the reflection, based on the mother, or as Ringo Togo said, to take to whom you feel most dear in this life, who you feel the most gratitude for, who has acted in your mind the most kindly towards you. If not your mother, then, you know, in having given birth or through gestation and then giving birth. But if you have a difficulty with that particular focus, then again, choose someone else to whom you feel tremendous love and affection, and affection for. And says, you imagine them right in front of you, being cut up by some people and being beaten, boiled, or burned by others. Or perhaps their body is completely frozen with cold to a point where it is covered with cold sores, blisters, and cracked open. If this were really the case, would you not experience compassion for this person? Since it is a definite fact that those beings suffering in hell have also been our mothers, and that they are currently enduring such sufferings, how can a compassion not arise toward them too? Cultivate actual compassion by contemplating in this way and by wishing those beings to be free from suffering and its causes. Equally, were your own mother or the being to whom you feel most grateful to in this life, if this person were right in front of you, if they were tormented by hunger and thirst, afflicted by disease and pain, full of fear, utterly terrified, and completely disheartened, would you not experience profound compassion for them? It is certain that those hungry spirits who suffer torments like these have all been your own mothers. How can you not feel compassion? Contemplate this and wish them to be freed from their sufferings. equally if this person was right in front of you, old and withered by age, and yet other people nevertheless made them labor as a defenseless slave, beat them hard, killed or chopped them up alive, would you not experience great compassion? It is certain that those beings born as animals are subject to these sufferings, and that they were formerly your very own mothers. How can you not feel compassion? Contemplate this and wish them to be free from suffering. Equally, if this person were right in front of you, blind and near the edge of a precipice, 1,000 miles deep, unaware of their danger and without anyone who could lead them away or cry out, hey, be careful of the abyss. And then they started wandering towards the edge. Would you not experience very great compassion? It is certain that gods, demigods, and humans are all three standing at the edge of the abyss that is the lower state of suffering, or the lower states of suffering. Unaware of cause and effect, they do not know that to avoid falling, they must give up unwholesome action and practice virtue. Because they do not benefit from the support of a Dharma teacher, they fall into and experience the three lower realms. As it is then so hard to get out of those states, how can you not feel great compassion for them, since they too were formerly your own mothers? Contemplate compassion thus and wish them all to be free of suffering. And now just let go and relax and let go of clinging to whatever thoughts are arising, and just allow yourself to just relax, spacious in the present moment. And listen to the phone ring. Obviously, that's like the gong, I imagine. That ends that meditation. Oh, and my dad's not getting it. Okay, well, anyway. Okay, sorry. That's... Okay, so now we're going to... Now that we've been brought back to the reality of clinging to these things as truly existing, such that I felt irritation and a little bit of embarrassment. Okay, so now we're back to page 63, and we're going to finish out in page Rinku Toku's discussion of compassion. So I'm on page 63, the second paragraph, and it says, the more we develop compassion, the more natural it becomes. When one meditates deeply and constantly on compassion, one comes to a stage where one is compassion, and all selfishness, all egotism disappears. This is what we call the full accomplishment of compassion. So this speaks to the fact that the ultimate nature of mind, when one recognizes and fully realizes that nature of mind is has within it innately the full ripening of compassion, such that when one has let go of all ego clinging and dualistic perception, ordinary perception, conceptuality, and is experiencing empty awareness, compassion, a state of wisdom, rather, from which all actions seem to generate from, that compassion is simultaneous, which is why it says the full accomplishment of compassion, which goes again to the third type of compassion, which was without reference point, so that there's no longer any moment in that, at that level where, in that state where there's a sense of self and other as substantial stuff, that you could have some kind of reference point here and there, self, other, someplace, and, you know, again, a beginning and an end. It's beyond any form of reference. So that compassion is infinite, again, without any partiality. So back to the text, it says, Gampopa quotes the text discussing Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig's realization, which says, if there were one thing that could be placed in the palm of one's hand to represent all the Buddha's qualities, what would it be? Great compassion. He also quotes the secret sutra of the Tathagatas, which says, the all-knowing primordial essence wisdom is rooted in compassion. If you have developed the love that wishes happiness for all beings and the compassion that urges you to liberate all from suffering, you can no longer care for your own liberation only, and automatically, whether you wanted to or not, you have in fact become a bodhisattva. In order to become a completely enlightened Buddha, you need first of all to have become a bodhisattva. The development of loving kindness and compassion is therefore the true direct path to enlightenment. Even on a relative level, having a full heart of loving kindness and compassion can help us solve our temporary problems. If we're only benevolent or kind, loving, and compassionate, how could we possibly have psychological or mental problems? Such problems are born from selfishness, from attachment to oneself, and the consequent fear. Without attachment, there is no fear, and without fear, there are no problems. I just want to put a little thing here, because again, it's one of these all or nothing things. If we're only benevolent and compassionate, how could we possibly have psychological or mental problems? So I would say here that, you know, we have to be very careful here not to, again, blame people. Let's say, well, you know, well, you don't have, you know, there's no such thing of mental problems. Of course, there are things based on chemistry, et cetera, relatively. And how I'm relating to the next idea where it says problems are born from selfishness, from attachment to one's self, I would refer to these problems as being these sort of temporary mental problems that people without very serious issues of mental issues that, you know, can't so easily be worked through. That how I respond to this is something that I've, you know, Lamanola Rinpoche and other teachers have said, which is that basically ego clinging, this self-absorption in oneself, the need to protect, you know, believing there to be a truly existent I that we have to protect all the time, and we sort of feel threatened by anything other to this I, that is what is the cause of suffering, and that, you know, you become very contracted. You know, you're all, it's very tiny, and it's all about the single eye, which is very, you know, tight. And that all you need to do in that moment is, like, think about others in the sense of what I do at the monasteries. Just do something for others. In that moment, take a moment to simply do something for others. Because in that moment, you're turning your attention away from oneself. And in that moment, then, like, suffering goes away, because the source of suffering, you're not focusing on others. So that's another, it sort of reminds me of this idea of the first way of working with happiness, of loving kindness, which is to say that when you're feeling unhappy, replace that feeling with a set of conditions that make you feel good. So again, in this sense that here, without attachment, there's no fear. And I mean, that would be ultimate. And then ultimately we could cut through psychological, deep psychological or mental problems. But relatively for us, or for me at least, just recognizing when I'm feeling super depressed or bad or whatever, that if in that moment I focus on something other than myself, I notice that I don't feel as bad, because the source of suffering, that self-clinging, is not the focus of my attention. Anyway, continuing, it says, tolerance could be a first step towards compassion. Tolerance means forgiving, not bearing grudges, striving to understand more deeply the motivations of others, and not returning evil with evil, a basic attitude from which compassion can spring. Compassion is trying to solve problems on this basis. This means that if somebody wants to harm you, you don't answer hate with hate. And on top of it, you wish to help your adversaries to get rid of their hatred and its causes. However, one shouldn't confuse tolerance with passivity. Tolerance doesn't mean putting up with everything, allowing oneself to be exploited and beaten up. We should be compassionate and do what is good for others and ourselves. There are also certain things towards which we shouldn't be tolerant, for example, mental poisons. Tolerance isn't applicable to our own anger. We shouldn't allow it to grow and overpower us. Tolerance isn't applicable to those who kill and oppress other people, and we shouldn't let them do it. One shouldn't resort to violence, to arms, or conflict, but neither should we accept everything passively. We should defend firmly what we consider just, but avoid harming others as much as possible. And so this is a very important point, this last statement, because, and that concludes the chapter on love and kindness and compassion, but I think that's very important, this idea that we defend firmly what we consider just, but avoid harming others as much as possible. Because as you all know, in the last, I don't know, 20 years or however long, there's been this issue about, you know, activism within Buddhism and being activists. And this is a very important point, which is to say that you shouldn't accept anything passively, but then we should also be aware of our body, speech, and mind, and avoid harming others. And it's very important, because people then, in their attempt to get activate others, to bring others into a cause, you know, words can be very inflammatory, and there can be a lot of triggering in terms of the usage of the language that's used. The term violence itself can trigger issues with oneself. So you have to be really careful in terms of motivation, because you want to help others. Like I remember when I got out of my second retreat, and it was about the time that, I guess, whoever it was, the president at the time, was, you know, deciding to go into Iran. And I remember at the time I got out of retreat, and I was talking to an old friend from many years ago, and they were just incensed, you know, and there was such a huge emotionality there. Now I did get online with my mom. We, you know, we signed a, you know, put our name to a petition to say we were, you know, we'd prefer it not to happen. But other than that, I felt that, you know, so I did what I could that would function in a positive way, but I wasn't going to engage in the conversation with this person where it was just based in emotionality, and that, you know, where you're bringing up upset for people, you know. So it's just, it's a very, very interesting, you know, path to take, and to be able to actively benefit others and make a stand perhaps in certain situations, but remembering that as bodhisattvas, we're trying as best we can not to harm people through our body, speech, and mind. And is our motivation born of our own ego and our own opinions, or is it, you know, is it coming from a point of view of wisdom? So I just think that's an interesting thing. Anywho, so that's where I end now today's session on loving. That completes the chapter on loving kindness and compassion, the antidotes to thinking solely of your own benefit. So if anyone has any observances or commentary or questions, please feel free.
I'm unmuting Marilyn and Patrick.
We can't hear you.
Oh, no, they're muted again. I had them unmuted. You're unmuted. You're not muted.
Oh, let me try myself.
No, you're unmuted. No,
you're not muted. We can hear you.
Okay. I just was, Lama Jinzong did refer to this one particular section, but I'd like to go back to it for a second. Bottom of page 63, such problems are born from selfishness, from attachment to oneself and the consequent fear. I went into Gompopa to see what was going on in comparison, and my feeling is that it would help if that word selfishness weren't there. It would really help if it said such problems are born from attachments to oneself and the consequent fear, just because selfishness carries such a pejorative sense. And then what I did was I said to myself, the next sentence says, tolerance could be a first step toward compassion. So I just bumped it up there and said, added self-tolerance. Because those of us who deal with depression, I personally, immediately it sent a flag up, and it probably does with other people for other reasons. So I wish he hadn't used selfishness, but nonetheless, I think self-tolerance, I mean, tolerance could be a first step towards compassion, and we're always advised to, do ourselves first and then expand to others. So that was how I dealt with it.
Well, if you notice, when I actually got to that point, when I was giving my little blurb, I used the term self-absorption. I didn't say selfishness, which was me, like, you're just thinking about yourself, you know, and again, That's how I related to that, because I understand what you're saying with selfishness, you know, but to me it's being absorbed in oneself, and, you know, so that I agree with you. I think it's clinging to oneself as, you know, anyway, that's, I see what you're saying. Thank you. Yeah.
Fanny has her hand up, and I also just wanted to point out that these are Ringu Tulku's words, and as with other teachers who are not native English speakers, sometimes they don't know the nuances of words. So I'm sure he didn't mean it in a pejorative way. He probably thought it was equivalent to ego clinging, which it doesn't come across as. Unmute Fanny.
Okay. Hi, thank you. That was such a wonderful teaching, you know, a reminder. And going back to what Marilyn was saying, I was like, think of self-care and selfishness.
Self what?
You know, how to self-care.
Yeah, but what was
selfish, as opposed to selfishness.
Oh,
I see. Growing up with, like, my mother saying, you got to be selfish in this world. You know, she was a Holocaust survivor. You got to be selfish. And that never rung true to me, even though I've, you know, certainly cherished myself at different times. But what I really wanted to ask about this fine line of, you know, being in these settings where I work, I currently am working, and I'm seeing such marginalization. You talk about activism and, you know, being the passionate person that wants to affect change, but the system has a certain model, and how to like pepper something in, but you're really witnessing injustices and you need to speak up and you don't want to harm your colleagues that you're working with because they, you know, one of my colleagues just got laid off for standing up for the right thing. And all I could do was stand up for what she stood up for and said, wait a second, this was not an appropriate setting. I mean, there's a million stories that I'm seeing on the ground every single day that deal with people that are in, you know, I'm trying to have them call the lockdown units. I work with tremendously psychiatric folks that are so wise in some ways, but have been like marginalized, and they have nothing to do. And one guy came up to me yesterday and he goes, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, the Buddha said, and I went, oh my God. I said, why don't you start a Buddhist meeting? He's like a resident there. So I asked them if they could, you know, little things to affect change, not to be, you talk about like, you know, it's a thin line, like what satisfies my own feeling like I made an impact, you know, but really will help this person talk to this other person in Somalian. I spent like 6 weeks trying to get these two people to talk because nobody could understand them. But things like that, you know, without like just seeing where little help can be needed, you know, and going for it. But, can, you know, sometimes in these systems, it can get you in trouble, you know, which it does. So I'm still trying to manage that thin line of being respectful to the village, you know.
Well, you know, I think it really, the important thing to recognize is that as much as we mean well, you know, everyone's stuck in their own set of projections.
Filter,
and so
the, yeah.
Yes. And so that's where, like, I had this like horrendous experience in my second retreat. Well, horrendous. I mean, horrendous would have been, you know, my body cut up. I had an uncomfortable moment in retreat mentally where I remember, you know, as a second timer, you're usually sort of beat up because, like my second retreat, because the first timers are sort of, they need someone to blame. It's got to be, you know, someone in there, but whatever. So the point is, it was a first timer. And so we were introducing, it was one of these practices, and we were getting to the point of group practice, and she was going to be in charge of the shrine for that. It's called a chipon. But in any case, it's pretty extensive stuff that you have to figure out. And she happened to be a very smart person. And I wrote her, I don't know, some note that was just like, you know, supportive of her and saying she can absolutely do it, but offering my support and if she needed my help in any way. Well, she got so upset with me. She was like, you're just trying to butter me up and blah, 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 blah. And it hit me so strongly, like here I was, my intention was so opposite to how she perceived it. And I realized, like, you know, another thing is there's this book, you know, called Having Difficult Conversations. And one of the like most important points is that you can never assume that like whatever your reaction is to somebody. So equally, whereas you can't control somebody else's projections, it's also your own, because the idea that if I feel like a certain tone, someone has said something to me and I react in a way, that the reaction is not equal to the intention of the other person, that you can't know the motivation of the other person. There's just too many things we don't know about each other. The moment, in that moment of time, is someone grieving over something? Is someone upset over something? Is their tone of voice coming that has something completely different from you, and yet you take it personally? So I guess what I'm just trying to say is that it's so difficult because, as Sai Sitra Rinpoche said years ago, we're basically only communicating to each other, like we only have like 10% of 1% that we actually understand, that our communication most of the time is like 99.9% miscommunication, because we can't really hear what people are saying, and we can't really, because we're always, like you said, filtered through our own thing. So I guess what I'm saying, Fanny, is that no matter how well we try, relatively, you know, you can try to do the best you can, but you never know whether what you're trying to do is in fact going to harm someone else, because it's always going to be filtered through their set of, you know, predispositions and mental dispositions. So you just try your best. But that's why in a lot of times, Lamanorla Rinpoche, you know, a lot of things would happen at the monastery. And you're like, how can you put up with that person's behavior? And it was such an act of compassion, because he really saw that this person was not acting out of any kind of wisdom. That person was acting solely out of ignorance, was creating all of their causes. They were creating all of their future suffering, which is why he basically never kicked anyone out, because it was like he saw the bigger picture. And so he had tremendous tolerance based on this knowledge that people are not acting with any kind of wisdom. They're acting out of ignorance. And so oftentimes he would say, you know, it's like if you saw somebody that wasn't doing their job, he would, and I'd get all crabby, you know, they're not cleaning up, they're not doing, he would say to me, if you're feeling well enough to do the job, go for it then. But if you're not, leave it alone and walk away. And don't let it, don't think about it. You know, if you can do something functional that changes, that does the job then, but you get uptight with that other person. You know, so, I mean, I know what you're dealing with is very heavy duty. I mean, it's the injustice in the whole world, but I don't, there's no easy answer in this case. Does that, I'm sorry, I don't know if that helps.
No. You know, it's good to just dialogue and be in fellowship, you know, and with each other. That's helpful alone to say. And, you know, I'm in, on another note, I'm in a new relationship with someone for 8 months. And it's really interesting. There's a big age difference and things are, you know, lovely. And I'm just recognizing how not biting certain hooks, you know, in terms of getting to know one another and getting to know each other's, you know, culturally difference, how the Dharma is so helpful to see, you know, that we're not operating, we trigger each other, I'm saying, that we're not operating from our true essential selves. You know, to really have that seed, even though it can go either way sometimes, has made such an impact in the dynamic of the relationship to really just say, I want to try better. I want to not, like, talk about anger. You know, I don't want to just live in this space because physically it doesn't feel well. I feel contracted. I don't have my energy available to me to be of benefit, blah, 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 you know, the rest of it. So, again, you know, all this reminders and years and years and years and years and years of neuronal grooves being expanded, I would say, you know, and the from the science point of view. So I'm really, you know, personally and professionally just trying to bring it in a practical way to myself and others that they're equipped with what they need, you know, bottom line. You know, anyway.
Well, good luck.
That's why I need support. That's why I'm here talking to everybody. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Chichen, did you have anything to add?
I don't think so. Thoughts popped up, but nothing, you know, nothing really pressing.
So let's say, Lama Chodron, we have about 10 minutes left. What should we do?
We could talk about next week.
Okay.
Does anybody have anything, like anybody who hasn't spoken up and was kind of waiting? Does anybody have anything else to ask or to say? Joanne, I'm unmuting you, Joanne. You are now unmuted.
This might pertain to next week, but I'm trying my best to wrap my head around the 24th practice to regard adverse circumstances as delusion.
With the 37 practices you're talking about?
Correct.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that this next week's session might give me the, I'd like to say wisdom to understand how an adverse situation is a delusion of my mind when I'm perceiving someone in great pain. Of course, I bring to mind the four immeasurables, the third one in particular, that may all sentient beings remain in the state of pure happiness that transcends all suffering. That, and I'm not doing what Fanny does, but once a month, I do go into assisted living facility, very difficult situations, and yet I am not intimidated by what I perceive. And just as Lama Jinsong had pointed out, those experiences, I forget myself entirely, and I walk away having done something that perhaps made a difference in each of those persons' day. And I'm not doing that out of pride. I self-examine and it's not pride. I deep down, I think that the Dharma has helped me do what I'm doing. So that's my final word.
Well, that's remarkable and wonderful, but so I'm not sure what your question then is, because it seems as if
my question is that next week's session might address the 24th practice of ultimate bodhicitta.
I think, do you want me to jump in here for a second?
Please, go for it. It's you're on the court.
The 24th is falls under ultimate bodhicitta, and that is going to be the sixth paramita. So that's where we're going to delve into that. But for me, the shortest answer to that, it's not a complete answer by any means. And as Lama Jinzong said, addressing the really true adversity and injustice of the world is like very hard. It's hard to know how to do that without causing harm. But I don't think that the verse is saying that adversity is illusion or delusion. It's the suffering that it brings us. So when we take it as truly inherently real, that's where our suffering comes from. And so we're being encouraged to see it as a dream, but it doesn't mean that bad things don't happen. Bad things definitely happen. And we do our best to, you know, as you and Fanny have both brought out, we do our best to make those situations better. But this is actually also the third kind of compassion, is just recognizing people create their own suffering, and they get caught in the karmic consequences of, you know, whatever has happened in the past, things that we can't even know. We can't even know where things come from. So you have to, you know, we deal with adversity all the time. We deal with injustice and we deal with horrible situations. So as a bodhisattva, you go into it with that. What helps the most is to go into it, from my point of view, with the recognition that on some level it is a delusion and it comes from karma, and it's not, as the Buddha said in the First Noble Truth, it's not fixable per se. You can't make those things not happen. You can't make other people not suffer. So I'm going to wrap up just by saying I think this really relates to those three kinds of compassion. You feel compassion for the person suffering. You wish for them not to suffer. You recognize how it fits into the Four Noble Truths and how things work, how karma works and so forth, that it's beyond our capacity to unravel it. And then you just recognize that it's just the way samsara is, and recognize it as ultimately not real. It's not permanent. It's not real. I said that in a pretty, you know, random way.
That's really good.
Okay, we have Valerie. Valerie, what have you got to say?
I kind of believe that it has a purpose. I don't know what it is, but I do believe that.
What? I'm sorry, that what has a purpose?
It has a purpose.
That what?
Suffering has
a purpose.
Well, certainly in the sense that it comes from our karma, like to recognize that it comes from karma, it comes from causes and conditions. And it's also our stick. You know, Pema Chodron said that the thing about the human realm is that it alternates pleasure and pain. And so the suffering is what reminds us that we don't want to get stuck here. If we're suffering, we're still in confusion. So we want to liberate ourselves from that. So those are a couple of thoughts on it.
I can't speak to it any better than that, Lama Jirgin. Thank you for those. But one thing does come to mind now, which is what Thaisiddha Rinpoche said many years ago when he was visiting before the fourth retreat was going in. And in one of his teachings, he said, well, you know, everyone talks about wanting like world peace and like the big picture. You know, everyone wants things to work out right. And yet people can't even get along with the people in their own household. And so he's just bringing it again to, like, you know, this whole thing of, you know, you aspire globally, but you have to act locally. And that in the end, the only thing we can control is how we respond to our own thoughts, how we perceive our own thoughts, and how we then work with them, and that we have a choice. And that we don't actually have to act out with our body, speech, and mind. And that in the end, the only thing we can do, well, you know, we can't control our own thoughts, so how can we control anybody else's? We can't control the conditions around us, so how can we expect anyone else to control the conditions around them? Like we ask others to do, or we have expectations that others should act, you know, always from a point of view of wisdom when we ourselves can't do that. And yet we still expect that of others. So it's that when it really comes down to it, no matter how horrific stuff is outside, and we all understand that, you know, and if we can hopefully understand what the point of karma is, that none of this is acting just randomly, that there are previous causes and conditions then come together that certain situations arise, but most importantly is that we continue to work on ourselves and make our small circle of influence and the beings around us and our particular social interactions as kind and as gentle as can be, and that we don't harm, you know, forget about trying to benefit other people. Lamanola Rinpoche said the first thing is try not to harm them. You know, and just also Sanjay Tenzin Rinpoche said many years ago, he said, what is it that says that, you know, the sign of how well you're practicing is how kind you can be in each and every interaction. And that's basically the point, and that slowly through your changing and being able to be a source of calm in the storm, then other people are affected around you in a positive way. And if you can do that all the time, then you've really gotten somewhere. And that's basically what you can do. And anything else is fantasy, really. Anyway, that's
what well I'm... said, Lama Jinzang.
Okay.
John Renish is asking if we can get a copy of the Four Noble Truths that you shared.
Yeah, I'll just email it to you guys. Okay. I just found it online, and it has the guy's name on it.
Marty Marvin McLeod.
Do you know who that is?
Yeah. Yeah, he was old New York City, connected with one of the teachers. I think it might have been Shambhala.
Oh, and all I did is he just had the four truths as suffering, cause of suffering. I added the truth of the truth of the truth of just because it was clearer to me. So sure, I can just email that to you all right after the class. Not a problem. So 3:30. So speak to next week then, Lama Chodron.
Okay, so we weren't quite sure how long the love and compassion chapter would take, so we didn't make a decision until today. But I'm going to be away next week, and it's going to be my turn to teach the next chapter. So we're not going to have a class next week. And also Lama Jinzang is in Florida, and her father needs a lot of, you know, help getting to doctor's appointments and so forth. So for both of us, it's better if we just don't meet next week, so hopefully everyone will use their time wisely, as we will be doing. So then we'll meet again on the following. So next week's the 21st. We won't meet on the 21st. We'll meet again on the 28th and start the next chapter, which is Bodhicitta, I think. Oh, Taking Refuge. That's a really great chapter.
So that's page in at least the white book copy. That's page 99. Yeah. And it goes until it looks like 99 to 110. So the idea is, because I was confused by this myself, is read it in the Gampopa book and then just read in this book whatever works with it, because this book takes 15 pages, I believe. It goes from like something, I don't know what I, because I've already talked to Lama Chodron about this, that I was confused. It, you know, this book goes from like takes 15 pages to cover what it takes 50 pages in Gampopa. So we're going by this book's chapters.
In Ringu Tulku, it'll be page 64 to page 76. But he covers slightly different territory in this section. But, you know, read them both, especially the Path to Buddhahood is always going to be our primary, you know, practical text. But it's a wonderful chapter, Taking Refuge. So I'm looking forward to it on March 28th.
I'm sorry, could you just repeat? You said that the chapter then is in Ringo.
Ringo Tulku, it is, I just closed my book.
It's 64 to 70. 76. Okay. 76. Okay.
The main point of it is refuge, but the chapter, I don't remember if it does this in both books or just Ringu Tulku, but he goes into an explanation of the three kayas, which is a very advanced topic that will be addressed much later in the book. But in terms of explaining what the Buddha is, like he explains what each of the three refuges is, and it's a lovely explanation if anyone is all fuzzy about what the three refuges are. And the Buddha refuge is explained as the three kayas, and it's a really, really nice and helpful explanation. All right, anybody else before we do our dedication? Okay. I think I'm going to mute you, Lama Jinzong, and Valerie, muting Valerie. I think everybody else is muted. I have to find my prayer sheet. So let's bring our minds to rest again. And thank you very much, Lama Jinzong. That was a fabulous explanation the last 2 weeks of love and compassion, the antidote to the third obstacle to awakening, which is being completely absorbed in one's own path to peace. Dedicating the benefit of this study, contemplation, and practice to the enlightenment of all beings, including ourselves. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Okay, everybody is unmuted. Yeah, have a great 2 weeks. We'll see you again. Same time, same cyberspace.
Sounds good.
Thank you. And I'll email this to everyone now.
Okay, thank you, Lama.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Spring, happy spring almost.
Happy spring, Fanny.